Welcome back to the Founders Music Lab, the music and startup community. You'll notice that we have two intros this week. After taping a few of the other episodes, we realized that I really suck at these intros and that we needed to prepare you for why we feel these guests are key to understanding the world of music and startups. This week, we talked to Noel Castell. We just love talking to Noel. He defines everything we feel represents FML. He's an accomplished musician with a full life of musical experiences, and he's also a serial entrepreneur. We talk about his very early days and the people that influenced him, how he made his life his own, his thoughts on learning and evolving, and his time with the boys from Wham! For the musician and the startup, there are some very valuable lessons in here. The biggest takeaway for me was his commitment to being true to himself. And the other important lesson was that there are so many more ways to succeed. Welcome to FML. Glad to have you here. And as usual, given this is our second episode, let's make this usual. We've got Ed here from Echo Coffee. We've got Steve from wherever, Music Land, and myself, Bill. And today, we've got our first guest, our pioneer guest. We'll see how this goes. So our first guest is Noel Castell. Noel Castell is, I was introduced to Noel through Steve. They had done some work together in the music industry. They know the same people. They're both extremely passionate about music. Noel has one of the most colorful and incredible lives I've ever heard of. And I say that respectfully. He has a career in music, played with Wham. He's part of their band. He's been involved in a number of music initiatives throughout his early life, and then ultimately got into flying, started flying schools. He's a commercial pilot. He's a race car driver. He's got incredible stories, incredibly intelligent. I said that so he stays. And he's got one of the best accents I've ever heard.
there's no evidence for any of this.
There's no evidence. There's no fact-checking here.
I try to hide the evidence.
This is probably... It's with Jimmy Hoffa.
That's me with Jimmy Hoffa.
You are Jimmy Hoffa. You changed your name. All right. Well, welcome, Noel. Thanks for coming. I appreciate this.
Cheers, Bill.
Cheers. Ed, we're going to start off, I think, because Ed's our coffee dude and is going to be a very important aspect of what we do and how we actually started this whole thing around a cup of coffee, just talking, enjoying the conversation, talking about life, talking about creative initiatives, goals, projects, ventures, whatever. As I've mentioned in the previous podcast, Ed is the owner of Echo Coffee and Echo Cafe. He's got coffee plantations in Colombia. He does ecotourism, specifically around coffee and the whole community of coffee. And today we're going to start, and hopefully every podcast we get something out of the coffee world that Ed wants to
showcase?
No. Oh, yeah. Showcase? Yeah, that's
sure.
A good one. Thanks.
All right. Well, today I decided we're going to start with the hot weather that's coming and everything. So we're going to go with cold brew. We have a Brazil pea berry. It's our usual cold brew that we offer. It's a low acidic coffee. There's no acidity because of the method. And it's rich in nuttiness and smooth as could be, hot or cold. But it's also... significant component of some of the things we sell. You talked about us having coffee farms. We have a plantation in Colombia. And so we do also, bring direct. And that's one of the things that we enjoy doing. But we want to feature a different thing every time we get together, depending on who the guest is and what they like or don't like, and we'll try to get better at it as we go along. But it also makes a lot of noise, so I have to do a lot of prep ahead of time.
Because Steve says we can't.
We're not allowed to make noise. You know how hard that is?
Keep it down.
Yeah, it's really hard to stop these ice cubes from making noise. I don't know how that works.
Now my microphone's wet.
Oh, my God. And these little cookies that he brought.
There you go.
This was good TV.
But anyway, Noel, welcome. It's great to have you here. I'm excited to hear about all of the things that you have transpired in your life. And so it's an interesting way to get to know people, to ask them about their lives, what they do, and how we ended up crossing paths here. So I'm excited for today. And I'll flip it over to Steve to give us his intro.
This episode brought to you by Eco Coffee. Be sure to visit Eco Cafe in the village of St. Jacobs. We're pleased to offer Eco Coffee products on our website at foundersmusiclab.com.
You know that feeling when a track just hits? That's Eco Coffee's signature blend espresso. It's been the undisputed leader of our espresso bar since the jump, and we're not changing the set list. Why mess with perfection? This isn't some fleeting B-side. It's a chart-topping shot that's bright, balanced, and sweet with a crema so smooth it's practically a baseline. No remixes needed.
And now, back to the podcast.
Noel and I met at the Tuesday night blues jam at the Jazz Room with the McKinleys, which is always a good time. And we always had lots to talk about. And we started hanging out, and then I said, Bill, you got to meet this guy. How fun is he? And then we hung out, and that was a blast. And now we're here. That's the real fast version. Because my stories are not nearly as interesting as his. So
that's why we have to invite people.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was fun, actually. Because when we first, I remember what happened was we met and... And I was supposed to just come, oh, let's just go have a cup of coffee. And like 4 hours later, we're still there shooting the breeze and laughing and drinking coffee and sort of messing about.
I'd have to say that was the impetus for this podcast, because I remember leaving that thinking, man, I wish I had recorded that. And then a few weeks later, we're having these conversations with a few other people and we keep saying, man, I wish we recorded that, but I will say, Noel, you are the one that really inspired amongst anybody that we were talking about. That's why we wanted to have you first.
Oh, well, I mean, it's fun. We're all sort of armchair philosophers, right?
So
we're just sort of,
is that what it is?
Trying to make sense,
Well, yeah, that's the whole reason for FML.
Yeah.
Founders Music Lab or F My Life. Take it as you will. Trying to figure it out and figure what we're going to be when we grow up. So, Ed, did you have a question? Because this is something that Ed likes to do with anybody he meets.
Yeah, usually within the first couple of minutes of meeting someone, the first question I always ask, because I'm interested truly in other people's worlds. So my world is coffee. I know it, eat it, breathe it. This is what I do all day long. But I always ask people, what do you do? What's your day-to-day look like? Because it's fascinating to hear people that you cross on the street and they have this complete life that we know nothing about. And so that's kind of my interesting angle. It's just like kind of what do you do?
Mm. What did I do today?
Both. What do you do for a living? What's your normal routine? I mean, away from the microphones or the performances or the flights in your case.
Well, I fly a Boeing jet for a cargo company, and we haul all that stuff. What is it in Top Gun? The rubber dog shit from Hong Kong or whatever it is. All the cargo, all that crap you buy on
Timu.
All that crap.
That's
you
where
buy
it comes from. You're the guy.
That's how it gets there.
Yeah.
Can you fly the plane a little faster sometimes?
Yeah. It's not getting there fast enough.
He's lucky to have it stay together.
So you know, especially Amazon and DHL and all these guys. So I work for a company that subcontractor that picks their stuff up and drops it in other places. But it's a job like any other job. and mostly it's fun.
You got into flying even before you got into music, or you may have been slightly in music, but
I was in music since I was five, because my mum's a singer. She had a jazz band for years and years. And I sort of grew up in pubs, which is a great place to grow up, watching my mum play with
lessons.
A band.
Great life lessons.
A trad jazz band, like traditional jazz.
Yeah.
So with great arrangements. I mean, just like the arrangements, the way that music, with the counterpoint and the, you know, you've just got a clarinet, different kinds of bass. Sometimes they'd have a sousaphone bass.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes they'd have a double bass, but mostly it was the sousaphone bass, which is kind of fun. You know, that's the big thing the marching bands have in New Orleans.
Yeah, yeah.
Great big thing.
That's wild. In a room.
Yeah, in a room with a clarinet and usually a cornet, not a trumpet. And then the clarinetist of the band was I think he just died recently, but anyway, he. Extraordinary arranger. So if you ever listen to the traditional jazz music, you'll hear that all the really clever stuff is going on actually with the clarinet.
Right.
Absolutely. The trombone, if you get to have a trombone.
Yeah, and then nice a trombone counter. Player they had as well. So there's always the trombone playing against.
Back and forth.
And so I grew up listening to that. My mum was the singer in the band. And they used to do some original music and stuff, but all the standards and all the traditional jazz standards. So I grew up around it. And my mum's brother is a concert pianist, went to Juilliard, studied under a fellow called Louis Kempner back in the day. So extraordinarily talented pianist. But the funny story with all – and my mum's dad, my granddad, Reggie Mott, he was one of those guys that could do everything. So he was a physical, like a PE instructor with the Navy or the Air Force or whatever it is, a place called, I guess it would be the Navy, HMS Northwood, which is where they used to, there still is the NATO command center in Europe. And so he was the PE instructor. I guess it was towards the end of the war there, and met my grandmother. But he was an extraordinary musician. He could sing. He could play guitar. He was a dancer. He was an acrobat. He could do everything. They used to do the soft shuffle, you know, like that sand dance shuffle stuff. You name it. It was sort of Mr. Vaudeville. The guy was just an extraordinary talent. So I guess all that side of my mum's family's music, it all came from him. And it sort of, you know, flowed towards me, I suppose. And so I was always surrounded by it,
yeah,
by music, but very different kinds of music. And it changes you, right? You it's your sort of frame of reference. So spent a lot of time going down different places. I mean, from a very young age with my mum, some of my earliest references.
So were they teaching you?
No. So the funny thing was the concert pianist, my uncle, of course, my mum goes, Noel's already sitting at home playing the piano, like 5 years old, right? I'm starting to play the piano and just picking out tunes and stuff. And it shouldn't be any trouble. We'll send it off to Uncle Tony to teach him to play the piano. That'd be great. So,
like, it's the last thing he wants to do.
But I mean, he declared me after a month of this unteachable. And to this day, I still can't read music properly.
Really,
I decipher it at best. I cannot sight read. I find I have a really hard time doing it. It might be partially because I've always found it easy just to hear something and play it.
That's really interesting. I mean, I've talked to people who have been concert pianists, or they've been they've always read music, but they can never jam.
No.
Because they can't feel it.
No, my uncle Tony, I mean, if you play him, you know, a piece of Ray Charles or something and say, hey, you know, it's in that key, go for it. He'll just look at you. He goes, well, have you got the music?
Well, he's unteachable.
Yeah, he's unteachable in that respect.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's horses for courses. It's, but just because you have a talent in it, I mean, it doesn't mean that you do one thing, you might not be able to do the other. But what's harder now is that when you're young, it doesn't matter because you're just using massive amounts of your memory and your brain capacity to just soak up music. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, I mean, if any record that you used to listen to when you were 15, you could probably tell me the lyrics. You know in your head exactly how it goes, every last note in the solos of, you know, I mean, you probably listen to Led Zepp 4 or something. Like, you probably got note for note
nailed
in
it.
Your head. Nailed it, right?
Nailed it.
Yeah. So... But as you get older, you know, like I can remember the names of anybody, like, you know, I met when I was 16, 17, but like, I can't.
I'm Bill, by the way.
Yeah,
I was just going to ask him, what's your name again?
What's your name again? And it's like that with music, isn't it? Because it's like, I used to have 1,200 song lyrics in my head because I was a lounge lizard. I was a sort of human jukebox. It was my job. But I can't sit down now and learn song lyrics. It's just like, oh my goodness, it's like it's too hard. Now I wish I could read music,
right?
Because you could use that as a backup, arrange stuff. You have a great idea. Oh, that's great. Write it down. So now I guess I have to really start to learn how to use the technology that's out there, where now recording music is so much cheaper than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's memory, it's almost free. So I can have however many gigabytes I need of memory and turn on my Logic Pro or my little recording device or whatever, and I can have as
back,
much as
going
I want.
Back then to when you were younger, how are you, like, you're learning all these songs, you're absorbing all these songs.
Mm.
Is it just trial and error? You're picking up the guitar, you're plunking around on the piano and you're feeling it out. Like, you had to get to some level of mastery to be invited or accepted into a band. What was that process like from 5 years to then? How did you absorb or gather enough capability?
I mean, if... I guess from about 5 years old through to when I was probably 16, I must have spent at least an hour every day at the piano. So if you
just voluntarily.
Yeah. Because it's, well, you know, some people do yoga, some people do whatever. But the thing about music is it's something that requires... If you get in the zone with it and you're mm-hmm. really concentrating on what you're doing, you end up 100% of your mental capability is absorbed, is focused on what you're trying to do.
So do you think it was because you were surrounded by music that you wanted to be a part of music
with it? Or? No, I think the reason was that it became my place to go. You know, things happen, whatever. But it's a place, it's a habit, it's
right.
and it's that place where.
But nobody's making you do it.
Nobody made me do it.
I think that's the key.
Yeah,
like I always look at it, I look at a lot of these creatives and creations, and I always revert to that art is actually in the word start, and art is more of a feeling than it is a technique. And as you encompass or sort of get the feeling or play with the emotional side of it, play with the feeling of it, you get to make it more of yourself.
Mm.
Like it's more of you as opposed to being trained to do scales and trained to do songs and trained. It's not you. You're being forced to do that.
Yeah.
But when it's coming internally,
yeah,
and you can develop it from there, it becomes more meaningful. But and more authentic, I think.
Probably for you too. I mean, you as well.
I'm good at nothing, so it's good at coffee.
But it's the story of your life, right? Yeah.
People struggle,
I'm a horrible employee. I'm terrible at. Yeah. I'm fortunately the only thing I'm able to do is I'm married and I'm good at that.
Took practice.
Yeah. Well, years. Not only just the once, but lots of
yeah,
years.
Yeah, no, I know, once. But you didn't.
But other than, you know, with my wife, I'm very bad at being told what to do. I'm a horrible employee. I really am, because I'm like, well, why would you do it like that? And then I tell them, you shouldn't do it like that. Have you tried doing it like this? And they look at you like, you know,
we've always done it this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. But we pay you to do. We don't pay you to think. Stop thinking. Just do as you're told. Right?
Didn't we cover this in the last podcast?
Well, see, we may come on a consistent theme. It'll be the same thing. It's like, we're not good employees.
Yeah.
This podcast is for people who are terrible employees.
I think, but that's part of it, right? Because it's musically too. It's like, oh, that piece of Mozart, dee, da, 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 da. It's like, oh, do I have to?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Actually, there was a funny story when I was a little bit later, because my parents tried a couple of times to get me to learn music properly. And I was doing my music O-level in... we call them public schools. They're private schools in England. Mm-hmm. It's actually called Merchant Taylor's School, but we used to call it Merchant Failures, which is quite funny. And I was doing my music O-level, I guess, and was then being sort of forced to read some music and do a little bit of music theory and this and that. And by then, because I'd been listening so much of the traditional jazz, I'd picked up a clarinet. And I'd started playing the clarinet quite a bit. And so they go, well, why don't you go off and have clarinet lessons? We've got a clarinet instructor. I says, sure, no problem. So I went up there, you know, did the thing. He played me a bunch of stuff and said, you know, and it was like really simple stuff. And I go, well, you know, I've been listening to some classical music, you know, Mozart trio and you know, concertos and stuff like that. It's pretty decent. I wouldn't mind learning to play some of that. He goes, well, you know, like, you know, when you get to grade whatever it is,
right.
You
got, yeah.
I'm looking in like years into my future. I go, well, why don't I just do it this week?
And Mozart clarinet concerto on your first lesson.
All okay, right, buddy. So anyway, he goes, all right, smarty pants. Here we go. I got the music for it. Blah blah blah. I go da 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 dum 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 da da da, or whatever that the Mozart thing. Not that, but that's that same minuet in G again. Sorry, the
clarinet concerto.
The clarinet concerto. Da 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 dum 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 da 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 dum. That's a Mozart thing, anyway.
Yes.
So that was the piece. I forget what it was called, which whether it's a concerto or a trio or whatever. Anyway, but it was like, okay, well, there you go. Why don't you learn that? He's like, We're going to deal with him, right? Okay, fine. So on my way home, there was a north of where we lived, on my bike on the way back from school to the house, there's a music shop, a record shop. So I go in the record shop and they had this stuff called Music Minus One. You could buy an LP with the clarinet and the orchestra. And on the B side, it had just the orchestra. And I already had the music.
So you could play along with it.
So I go, well, great. So I take it home, put it on the record player, go blasting off into this thing. Oh, I'm playing this Mozart. Not badly, actually. So I go, well, there you go. There goes my clarinet practice. That took about an hour, right? So the next week I get forced down to this music lesson and this guy shows up and he's, okay, so how are we doing, Noel? How's it working with the Mozart? Like, ho, ho, ho. I go, well, it's not bad. I'm getting along with it, you know. I didn't tell him I bought the record. Right?
No, of course not.
So he puts the music on there and I go blasting off into this thing and he sees me playing this. He's going like, wow. So he deliberately turns over two pages at once, and I just keep staring at him going, right?
God.
Busted.
Oh, man.
So I don't know why we got onto that subject, but that was one of my earlier musical experiences where I dabbled with classical music.
I have a question for you. So, like, I have a 14-year-old who's an elite athlete, right? Mm. One of the things, the measuring sticks for me, if he really loves to play, is does he like practice? Mm. So you said that you just go off on these tangents on your own and like you were in the zone, which is the same thing that happens. But for me to measure him, it's all about if he's enjoying practice time, then the game time is the bonus. And it's sometimes not as fun because there's the pressure of winning and the pressure of parents and watching and cheering. As a performer, how does practice and that isolation of being lost in it on your own compared to performance and live performance and having that presentation component?
Well, I'm sure Steve's done way more studio sessions as a session player than I ever have, because he's a reader for a start and he can do arrangements and so on. So I think he'd agree when it's really funny how well you play and then the red light comes on. And now as soon as you try to make it perfect, you've sucked all that creative juice out of it. Mm. You play stiffer. I would much rather... I mean, I don't actually have many recordings of me at all doing anything. But it's amazing. I really don't. I couldn't put my finger on really any recording of me doing anything.
This might be your first recording.
It might. Yeah, almost. Yeah.
We waited this long.
Yeah. But so what I was saying is that the performance, like when he goes to play a soccer match, that's a much harder situation because you can't really be... You might not be able to be you. You can't be spontaneous because fear of making a mistake, and this comes to your whole business thing, right?
Right.
Bill, with the...
Yeah.
It's the fear of failure that prevents people from
even starting.
From even doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're on your own and you're playing the piano and now you've got a recording device and you can just switch it on and try to forget that it's on and then be as creative as you can... Or like I'm planning to do with my sort of little studio thing I'm setting up, where bring a bunch of friends in, have a bunch of beer, have a great time, and record 4 hours of it. And then go back and see if there's any really cool nuggets that were in there that was occasionally there's going to be moments of brilliance interspersed by... Mostly crap, I would imagine. But it's those nuggets that you're looking for, right?
Right.
And you almost never find those beautiful things in front of 1,000 people or when you're, you know, it's difficult. And I guess that's because you're afraid to fail in front of people.
We're right from birth, we're... Depending on your parents, obviously, and your social network and all that.
And sometimes in music...
There's expectations.
In music, sometimes it's the mistakes where it's the beginning of something.
Mm-hmm.
You play a different chord against something and you go like, ooh, actually, that wasn't half bad. What did I do there? Because it is for most players that are reasonably fluent, that play by... You're not actually thinking too hard about what you're actually doing. It's like the sound, the idea goes from your head straight to your fingers and bypasses the filtering and the processing a lot of it.
Once you get freer.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you're also listening to yourself more. You're not listening to other people. You're listening to yourself.
Mm.
Even when you're starting a business. If you're starting a business based on what somebody else thinks you should be doing... Or maybe you have the idea and you go to an advisor and you're counting on them to tell you what to do. It's not going to work. And you're always waiting for that failure. We're in Waterloo here. We have, at one point, we had 800 startups. And they're all being advised by professors and academics or corporate guys, and they're getting measured by people who have never ever done it on their own. They're being measured by people who could go to school or people who could pass exams, but they're not being supported, or I'd say nurtured, I think is a better term, by people who would say, well, think about it. What do you think? Does this look like a good, you do this, what's the reaction? If the reaction isn't positive, maybe you want to adjust it. What's the reaction you're looking for?
Is that because to continue with the music analogy, is because when you're trying to start an independent business, that's jazz.
That is jazz.
Right?
Very much.
Very much so.
Right? Whereas, yeah. So you it's very difficult actually to teach someone jazz who doesn't really listen to it.
Yep.
Right?
Right.
Almost
absolutely.
Impossible.
If I were to look at any of the very, very successful businesses here, they all stem from a passion that was internalized by the founder. And they kept with that. I mean, Mike Lazaridis with RIM, he's passionate about radio technology, about electronics, about quantum physics. He is passionate about it. He didn't go to school because he had to go to school. He went to school because he wanted to go to school. And when he figured that he wasn't getting as much out of it, he went off and did his own thing.
Yeah, before he even finished school. As
yeah.
Far as same Richard Branson, same thing.
Exactly,
said,
yeah.
Oh, forget this. I'm out of here. I'm going to go and run a magazine.
Right.
He went to the same school my brother went to, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Stowe School in England. Yeah, and yeah, the way the story goes, he goes like, well, I don't need to learn anymore from you guys. I got things to do. Bye, see ya.
Yeah.
And he's
funny.
Gone, right?
It's funny that you say that, because I was going to say earlier when you were talking about that, is there's a difference between the doers and the ones that are told what to do. And so, as an entrepreneur, is that's the only voice I could listen to that made sense, was doing. And so constantly doing and trying and failing and succeeding and failing again and failing again, but you just keep doing. And it's not, no one's asking you to, it's a passion, and it's that passion to do. Whereas in music, that's what I was originally asking, is where is there more love for that what you're doing? Is it while you're just doing it and being tuned out to the world, or showcasing it for others, whether it be just a group of friends that you get together and jam with, or the only thing I can assimilate that's other than business is sport, and I played volleyball for a long time, and I don't know where time goes when I do that.
Mm.
So I think that when you sit down and you just see a piano and you're like, oh, I need to communicate to that thing, and then you're lost for however long you sat down for, but you're lost in a perfect place.
Mm. And it's because you don't have to worry about anything else. But the other thing is that one thing leads to the next that leads to the next, and you don't go in with a specific purpose. I'm going to go in. I just have a lot of fun. I just mess about. I might, if I'm having a hard time thinking, well, what do I want to do? I'll maybe open the real book and I'll go, okay, fine. I'll try and get my reading chops together because I'm not feeling particularly inspired, and maybe I should learn to read music one day. So I start on that, but then a chord or something grabs my ear, or a mistake, and I go, well, that was interesting. What was that? And oh, actually, you know what? That happened in, like, probably a Stevie Wonder song, because Stevie Wonder taught
me
everything.
He can't read music either.
No, he can't. And maybe that's why I just
but he can feel it.
He can. Yeah.
Yeah. And but you know, you just feel something, and you go, oh, well, that's cool. Oh, and then you recognize it from something else. That's what he was doing in that. Oh, that's cool. And then you go, what was that song again? And then you're off to that place, right? Now,
right.
Yeah, you're on a journey. You're not quite sure where you're going,
yeah,
but you're going somewhere. And if you're really lucky, at the end of it, you end up writing a hit, although I've never written a hit. I've never really written anything. Nothing that I'm proud of or that I would actually say, hey, I wrote a song, here it is. Because I have a problem with this in that I guess my I know so much music.
Yeah, what's original?
Yeah, nothing's original.
And yeah.
So you go, oh, that's great, but, you know, I can't help drifting off into that bloody Stevie song again.
Yeah.
Or, you know, so a funny story actually about that whole thing was the Careless Whisper, because I sort of started research, like the George Michael song,
biggest hit, right? Yeah. Okay, and, before we start that,
yeah,
how did you end up connecting with him
and
Andrew?
Well, what happened was I was at I got thrown out of all the schools I got sent to, and I ended up.
See, this is how you learn not to fear failure. Because the more times you do it, you realize, it didn't kill me.
It just gets better, right?
It gets better.
I mean, I'd never had any opportunity at all. I'd got thrown out so many schools. So there I was in, it was called Harrow Tech at the time, Harrow College of Higher Education. It's up the road from the other Harrow school, you know.
Oh,
the good one. This is like technical college, but you could finish your A-levels there. And I had this idea that I was going to go be a pilot for British Airways. So and they used to train people from scratch. You never paid a thing, and then you'd do the thing, and then you'd get a gold watch after 50 years, and pretty good life, right? And you didn't have to, you know, pay for any of that. So that was sort of my plan. So I was doing math, physics, and chemistry A-levels. I'm not quite sure what the equivalent would be here. But and you do those, you specialize in some subjects to a certain level so that then when you go to do university, you've done what would be sort of maybe half your first year at university or something. I don't know where that would be.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I'm at Harrow Tech. My newfound freedom, because in between I got thrown out of one school and then they sent me off to this boarding school, which was hell. So it didn't take me long to figure out how to get thrown out of that one.
Right? If you were successful at anything.
Yeah. If it was, I got this already fit. I've already been thrown out of one school. Getting thrown out of this one, this is going to be a piece of cake.
I should write a book. Yeah.
These guys are so uptight. This is not going to be hard, right? So I got thrown out there as well. And ended up the only place I could, which was like Harrow Tech. It was the local, it was paid for by the government and everything. You won't have to pay anything. Went there and math, physics, chemistry. So anyway, I would be there. And they had this sort of big hall which had a piano, a grand piano in the corner. So, of course, in my usual, I still play an hour a day or whatever. So between my lectures, if I was ever at them, I would
part of the that's in the book. That's how to be thrown out. Don't go to lectures.
Yeah,
starting to add up.
Yeah.
Well, what had happened was that the reason to go and get the A levels, maths, physics, chemistry, was to get into the British Airways Flying School, which at the time was in a place called Hamble in the south of England. And while I was at Harrow Tech, almost immediately I got to Harrow Tech, British Airways had so many pilots in the pipeline that they didn't need, they actually closed their school.
Right.
So I'm going, well, what do I need these A-levels for? I'm already sick of school. I definitely don't want to go to university. That's just more of this. So I would be in the hall at the college just mucking about on the piano. And occasionally this very sort of extrovert guy used to show up in this hall, and he was doing something at Harrow College as well, probably art or something, right? And very ebullient, very gregarious, super nice guy, tons of energy. And he used to start showing up when I'm playing and talking about this and talking about that and talking about bands. And eventually he got around to the subject of this band that this friend of his was trying to start. And he said, you know what, it'd be great if you, because you play the kind of stuff that maybe he's into. And I think, and do you play anything else? I say, yeah, I play a bit of saxophone and, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And he goes, oh, that'd be amazing. I tell you what, I want you to come up to one of the band rehearsals. He lives up in Bushy. And I go, all right, fine. That's great. And I was already playing with like two or three different bands in the local area, like in pubs and things, even though technically you're not supposed to be drinking till you're 18 in the UK. But I was in bands from like, I mean, I followed my mum through pubs at five. So like it wasn't.
You're weaned on it.
Yeah, it wasn't a stretch, right?
So I
got a pass.
A pub pass.
Because as long as you weren't drinking, then you could play in the band, right? So anyway, I says, sure, why not? You know, I'm up for that. And then at the time, I was also running a mobile disco thing. So the sort of the entrepreneur in me with my best friend, Gav, who I'd known since I was 3 years old. He's actually a British Airways pilot now, among other things.
Oh, my God.
And he also has a band, a Queen tribute band in the UK called Ready Freddy.
Oh, yeah. No way.
Yeah. So he was my best buddy at the time, and he had bought a Ford Transit van. So I think that's sort of, you know what kids are like, right? And obviously real entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
This friend of George Michael, whose name I forget, but he's in the movie. He's the guy that he's following him around all over the place. His best mate, the producer guy that moved to Thailand eventually. And,
right.
And I forget the guy's name. Anyway, he was the guy at the college. And I guess they come up and play. So anyway, I went up one evening with Gav, actually. And I guess it was that time or one of the later rehearsals that there's that picture in Andrew Ridgely's book of me playing the saxophone. That was taken in January 1980. But anyway, so I'm up there.
There is proof.
Yeah, there is actual proof.
Okay, we're going to have to look this up,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, there's actual proof. Just started playing stuff, and they were playing the most awful, like, oh my God, what am I doing here?
No.
It's like, you're there, and it's like, oh, and it was this sort of like, oh, George is there with a black and white, everything was two-tone. They thought they were sort of mods or something.
Oh,
so
yeah.
they had the Parkers, like they'd come out of The Who, like the Quadrophenia, you know,
right.
The movie? This was their image. They had the black and white two-tone thing. They were playing ska, the sort of white reggae kind of
Police.
No, well, Police is not Police is way better than ska.
Yeah, well, I mean, they borrowed from it, though.
Yeah, they borrowed from it. Yeah, it was. But they went in a completely different way with it, which even then, hearing this stuff, oh, we've decided to do this and that, and I'm going like, oh, I hope it gets to be like the Police, you know, because this sucks. But I didn't want to be rude, and I didn't want to go like, well, these guys could actually do something, you know, but they're kind of interesting. It sort of piqued my interest. There was some interesting, they had an idea of what they wanted to do, but it was in a style that it seemed to me didn't really fit. It was like, it was so forced, this whole two-tone thing. It's like, I was thinking sort of, you don't seem to be having fun with this two-tone stuff either, actually. But anyway, we got to playing and doing all that. And that's how I got introduced to, they called him Yogurt at the time.
Yogurt?
Yeah, Yog or Yogurt, yeah. He only became George, like, much later.
Really?
Even after the Executive, yeah. Only it was, that was a sort of like Elton John used to be Reggie Dwight.
Yeah.
So
Yogurt is on his birth certificate?
No, it's something unpronounceably Greek.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, he's Greek, and it's Yogi whatever, and it's got Michele whatever. I forget his actual real names.
Yeah.
I mean, people do, right? But yeah, it was something very long and very Greek, and no one was going to remember that.
No.
So
can't even remember.
I can't even remember.
He was there.
You were there.
I was there.
That's all right. I already forgot his name.
Yeah.
But that's only because I'm old. Anyway, So that's how I ended up playing with these guys. And where were we going with this? We were talking about how things sound similar to other things. We got sidetracked on the George Michael thing.
Right.
But so it was very recently, actually, in the last 6 months, I was playing down at the Hoother with John McKinley. He says, oh, I want you to play this. Could could you do this Jeff Beck tune? I go,
nice.
Yeah, all right. So he sends me the link, and I hear this Jeff Beck thing. And I go, that's Careless Whisper. It's the same freaking song.
No way. Oh.
And it was before Careless Whisper.
Oh.
I'm going, because actually,
Yogurt stole it?
Well, no, actually, this is why I was saying I write all kinds of stuff, and I go, it sounds just like.
Yeah.
But how much does it sound just like? To me, it jumped out and it went, oh, it's Careless Whisper. And had I written Careless Whisper, I would have gone, sounds a lot like that Jeff Beck tune. But the story gets even funnier. So I learn this Jeff Beck tune, and then I go in and we played it and we did it. I said, well, why don't we do it as a medley of Careless Whisper in this song, right? Because people are going to go like, well, which song is he playing? This is great. I'm playing the Jeff Beck tune. And we blended the two songs together and did a medley, which was kind of cool.
That is very cool.
Wow. So that's like, oh, it's that song and it's still that song. And you can clearly hear it's the same song. There's a couple of different bits. So I thought, well, that's the end of that story. Then I go and So I went on Spotify, I listened to this Jeff Beck thing over and over again, and you know how you can scroll down to the bottom, about?
Yeah.
Go down to the bottom, and the credits, guess who wrote it? Stevie Wonder. It's actually a Stevie Wonder song.
Really?
And then I went back and looked, and then there's like three or four different versions of Stevie Wonder playing this thing. I'm going like, So isn't that cool? So
that's very cool.
So not only did Jeff Beck rip it off from Stevie Wonder.
But Stevie couldn't see it.
Stevie didn't see that, no. He could probably hear it.
He probably could.
Probably played it in a different key too.
To throw him off a bit.
and then that got... So it's... But is it... But they are individual songs.
Yeah, but they're an evolution.
They're an evolution of an idea, and that's why I've never been able to write anything. Because if I'd been sitting down writing Careless Whisper, I would have already gone, well, that's that Jeff Beck tune. Oh, isn't that Stevie Wonder song I remember?
Right.
Then that goes in the garbage, and then you keep going, and you have to keep starting again. But every song's like that.
So, you know, you talked about how you were invited out, and you said, yeah, okay, what the heck? I'll join you. And you're experiencing some hash of stuff that just wasn't appealing.
Mm.
But maybe I'll stick with it. And it wasn't the you didn't discount an idea right off the bat.
No, it was
you said okay, yeah, and then yeah, and. But then the other side, you're saying that you didn't give yourself a chance to be a writer because every song you started coming up with sounded like some other song that had already been done.
Mm.
And had you sort of shoved that to the back and just pursued it.
But you can't.
Right? Yeah, because it's always nagging, right?
It's there.
Yeah.
And when you deliberately learn as many songs as you can, then it's even worse because they're all in the library somewhere.
Try not to learn anything.
But that's how the brain works, right? You go, oh, that we got. It's all RAM, isn't it? You can.
Well, you're pulling from something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think, based on what you said, that all the music's been done? Do you like, but because we have such small capacity brains that over this, you know, the score of our lifetime is what, maybe possible 100 years if we can get that far?
Well, it's funny because if you look at, if you were sitting in 1966 or something around, you'd be going, well, I think we've just about done everything we can done and it's all starting to sound a little bit samey. And then Paul McCartney comes into the room and just, wow, what the hell, where did that come from? Right, that is like so not what we're hearing, you're going like, it just opened up a whole new world. Mm. It's like, how is it suddenly so good? Right. The writing, you're going like, and where is it coming from? Because you can't put the really great writers, you still can't quite put your finger on it, right?
Mm.
It's a lot less derivative.
You can't reference something prior to it.
Yeah. So anything I hear where I can't, where I go, that doesn't sound like something else. I go, my sort of gold standard would be, man, how proud would I have been to have written that?
Right.
I would have loved to have written that. And it's actually quite simple. And when you think everything's been done, and they take a simple idea and they go with it, and you go like, ah, and it just had its own life. Maybe that's why when these guys, they say, well, you know, I wrote the song in 5 minutes and it's the best song I ever wrote.
Yeah.
It sort of comes out of that.
The collection of...
That different place.
Right.
That's not... You know, you're not trying so hard.
You're letting it come to you as opposed to forcing it and trying to make it happen.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like, do they do a course in, you'd know this being an academic in this, do they do songwriting courses at school?
Yeah.
That's a crazy concept. Yeah.
I know. They teach entrepreneurship too. That's another crazy concept.
Be brilliant. Have amazing ideas that are unique and one of a kind. I don't have any, so I'll teach you how to do it.
Yeah. This is how you do it. This is how you're completely unique.
I've never done it myself, but this is how you do it.
Yeah, I've read a book. I wrote a book.
My degree is actually in music composition.
Oh, really?
That's what I studied, yeah.
At I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, hey, no, I'm very glad. I'm glad I did it because I learned a lot. And but what it is it gives you a lot of the tools that you need when the creativity hits you.
Mm.
And that's why, you know, Mozart was famous for, I've already written that symphony, but I haven't written it down yet.
Mm.
What he means is he's come up with a couple of the main themes, mm-hmm. and all of the rest of it is bookwork.
Yeah.
It's just copying. So it's not like he's inventing something completely new. If you were 100 years removed from his writing and hadn't heard it, you would hear Symphony Number 7 and Symphony Number 8, and they might sound fairly similar.
Mm.
And then you take all of those and you look at them and you say, okay, well, that's a little bit different. That's a little bit different. Then you learn what the unique part is. And I think even before, you know, we had modern computers, some of the early computers, people had put a lot of these compositions in and taught the computer to write a Mozart symphony. And they were, even back then, not bad because there's certain elements. So having a mastery of the elements, knowing all of your scales and your keys and knowing all the common chord progressions, it's like you get a great piano player and they could, like Bruce Hornsby, and you know, he can play anything. So, you know, get him going and say, no, do it a little bit more like this. And then they could just do it because they know it and they're fluent with it. And so that's a very fertile bed, having all of those skills. And then when you come up with something unique, it's a whole separate skill to take something, to come up with something unique and make it original. I think that applies to anything that you're trying to do.
I was just going
to
ask Ed.
You've got to have business skills. You got to have a good account. You have a team. You have to have an account. And you have to understand leases if you've got a space. You have to understand taxes and supply and all these different things. Once you have all that stuff... Like coming at that, not knowing any of that would seem impossible.
Mm.
But having that training in music, having that training in any field, having the experience and the training is a fertile ground for a place for those ideas to grow.
I was thinking about the formula for success is 20% inspiration, 20% perspiration, and 60% luck,
right.
Basically.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, it seems to me, just observing people, it just seems to me that's how it works. So the 20% inspiration is great as a songwriter or whatever, and maybe I'm just not allowing myself to go there. The perspiration part is the learning how to, you know, orchestrate and record and so on, and then promote, and then I think it's really is about 60%. Just you got to be in the right place, right time, run into the right people, know the right people, whatever.
And you just have to get out there.
But it's,
and start showing, start
doing.
You have to
make your luck, like in business.
Yeah, you make it.
There's the doing of all these things, but you also have to, like you said, have that big space for the luck to happen. Now, you can force luck somewhat, yeah. but it helps, but it doesn't necessarily always connect or hit home.
But luck is only there if you're open to it.
Yes. True. You have to learn to recognize it.
Yeah, yeah. But you can't be saying no to everything.
No.
Like, you have to be open to ideas and open to perspectives from other people. Ed, when he's doing his coffee, Ed went from being an engineer to being a coffee maven, and it wasn't a process. It was an evolution. You just got into it.
There was no school for coffee when I jumped in at that time. In specialty, it was kind of new. So you try to look and ask, and you know, you go to the foundation to learn, and they show you some PowerPoint slides and go, this is how you do it. And you're like, those are just bullet points. But what am I actually, where's the spaces that you're going to fill in for me? And there was no filling of spaces. So you go back and you're like, well, we're just going to make it up. And you start there and you just do, and you act and you react. So it's
right.
It's firefighting. And I mean, I think music's the same thing. It's like you have to be able to let the world happen, and how do you plug into that? And so in crisis mode, I think the best entrepreneurs are the calmest. And so probably musicians or performers are the same thing. When it's everybody else would fold because of the thousand people looking at you or whatever, you know what I mean? That most people would fold to that. But if you can be impervious to those things and be calm, you can face it. It's like a fire. You have to put it out. You understand that part. You have to act in order to do it. And then you let your instinct take over to make you get there. But most people don't have that. Most people, they just sit down and go, oh, I'm going to burn to death.
Right. Yeah.
But that's why the most fun I've had playing music is not on my own, but it's actually when you're playing with some people who play better than you do, or they've got more interesting things that you wouldn't. But now you're on the spot. You're going, I'm playing in a key I'm not really comfortable with. I can't. And sometimes that's the best situation, because what you do is if you play a lot on your own or as a performer, let's say I was going to go play piano bars and do my thing. If I'm having to concentrate twice as hard to play in C sharp, because it's all black notes and it's like, and those patterns and the things and the logic, just it's just harder to think through.
Right.
So I would never play anything in C sharp, even though a lot of Stevie Wonder songs are. And I have a theory about that. Actually, it's easier to feel where
it
you
is.
Are
yeah, playing in C sharp. He plays a lot of black keys.
Plays a lot of black keys, yeah. Which sounds like a joke with Stevie
there.
Wonder.
I'm not going there.
Please don't.
But it's actually true, because when you put your hands on the keys, if you can't look at it, you can feel your reference
points of references.
Your point of reference is there. You don't have to look down at all.
Right.
So it's easier actually to play. And then so he would probably have been doing that.
Interesting.
And then what you do is if you're playing on your own a lot, what you can end up doing, especially when you work as a pianist like 5 hours a night, 6 nights a week in Europe somewhere, which is something I did, like singing 30 hours a week.
Jeez.
Wow. You don't have the mental capacity or the patience to be like cooking everything fresh every time. What you end up doing is stringing a bunch of tricks together.
Right.
And because you haven't seen me play those tricks before, you go, oh man, this guy is awesome. Well, yeah, but I didn't just dream this up. I mean, it's relatively spontaneous, but it's stuff that you're stringing tricks together.
Right.
Right.
And this is why we practice at home.
Right.
To add more tricks
to
our bag of tricks.
So but, hold on. I have a question for you then. Do you do this when you fly?
Let's try this new thing.
I can just see you in a cargo plane, and there's this crazy downdraft, and you're like, if I just tip the wing a little bit, I can ride that current. But there must be something to that, too, because you have a passion for flying. And you,
I,
to me, that's scary.
And I actually have a passion.
I get on planes, but
I have a real passion for teaching flying.
Right.
And... So I'm working in an environment when I'm flying. It's part of what makes me such a horrible employee, by the way. When you know, they talk when as a teacher, they talk about the four levels of learning. So you have learn by rote, learn by understanding, application then correlation. So you've got your four levels of learning. And what happens in aviation is that everybody's trying to save money. And they're trying to take this, you know, what I call like the sausage meat, you know, like fresh pilots, but who have lower and lower experience. And you're trying to stuff them into a system, but you're using a certain amount of training. And everybody's trying to save money. And it's the same in every business.
Yep.
So what you do is to get people through their exams and the thing, and it's probably happens in academia as well. I don't know. I've never been anywhere near it. But
you kept getting thrown out.
That's on you, buddy.
but if you can teach somebody push this button and push these buttons in this order, and 99% of the time that'll work out just fine. And so you teach the geese guys to push these buttons in this order, and when an engine fails, you do this, and you turn this knob, and you press this button, and you do it this way, and everything's fine. That's all great, but they don't know what's behind the curtain. They don't know why they did it like that. Well, why didn't you do it a different way? Well, so that's frustrating for me. So then when I go fly with new co-pilots and so on, and they're fresh out of school, and we're flying about, and they go, okay, we do this, we do that. And I go, well, have you thought about how would you like to do it? And then you see how, if they actually understand what they're doing or not. Well, what if I did it that way? Well, yeah, there's 10 ways to do it, and 9 of them are perfectly okay, but you've been told to do it that way.
Right.
Right?
Right. Right.
So how are you ever going to get any better at this if you don't try a different way and stretch a little bit? Do what you like, as long as you understand what you're doing, and as long as I don't see you getting into us into a situation where it's like, no, we're getting out of my comfort zone now. I don't really see how this is going to end well.
You know? We're going straight down. This doesn't look
the
good.
The box is supposed to be on top of us.
Before you go straight down, I mean, there's a long time where these things develop.
And so you catch it early.
Yeah, you catch it way. But you see the learning process.
Yeah.
And then you become, as an airline captain, you become a mentor and a teacher, even if you're not a teacher and in the training department. Right. And it's the same to come back to the what I'm talking about with the music, where it's you go play with other people. Yeah, if I'm going to play 30 hours a week in a piano bar because it's my job.
And doing the same thing over and over
doing the same thing over and over again. You don't get much better.
Right.
You don't. No, that's assembly line work.
Yeah,
you don't get any better. You have to. So, and if I'm not getting any better, then I'm not having fun anymore.
Right.
Because the whole point is, I mean, I'll never be as good as I want to be. Mm-hmm. I'd like to be a great jazz pianist. I'm not.
Yep.
I hope one day to be. So I got to go play with other people. And so to come back to that, yeah, they stretch me. Hey, we're going to play this in this key. Well, guitarists always playing in sharp keys, which pianists mm-hmm. like flat keys. We don't want sharp keys now. So now I got to play in A and E and D and all these things. So I got to completely relearn all my tricks in different keys, which means different fingerings because the you're upside down. Where you'd put your middle finger is now like it's inconvenient.
Going up instead of
it's
down
going up. And, you can't be playing those keys with your thumb. It just you get tied in knots, right? So you've got to completely reprogram
what you were doing initially.
That autopilot, it's all muscle memory. You've got to reprogram it. So now you've got to think that much harder. And what I love about John McKinley's thing is you go there and you never know what you're going to get.
Nope. Yeah.
But we do it as a jam session, and that's the point. Somebody comes up, do you know that song? I think I've heard it once. Yeah, what keys you want in? Oh, okay, fine. Okay, 1, 2, 3, off we go. And you go like, whoa.
Now that's a ride.
Yeah, now I'm pedaling fast.
Yeah.
Right? You try to be the swan, right? It's pedaling like, fuck, excuse my friend. You're pedaling like crazy underneath, but it's all serene on the top, and you've got a smile on your face.
Yeah.
You
know,
I have no idea where this is going.
You found a chart on the internet, and you're trying to read it on your phone, and you're not sure if the chart's right.
Yeah.
And you can't see it. But
well, I don't have that problem because I can't read it anyway.
Yeah.
There you go. Oh, man.
Make it till you make it.
Yeah, or you look at the bassist's hands. Yeah. I play a bit of bass. Or the guitarist's hands. I play a little bit of guitar, enough to be dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, but at least I can see approximately by where his hands are going, I can see what chord he's playing.
As long as he doesn't capo.
Yeah, and then, well, yeah. But then I have a transpose button on my keyboard, I try not to use it. But when the capo goes on, occasionally I go transpose.
Well, they're
button
cheating.
To keep
so
up.
What the heck? Yeah,
exactly. It's all fair.
These guys hate that.
It's not auto-tune.
It could be worse.
Yeah, it's not that kind of crime.
So I'm curious to know, following playing with those guys, you know, George and Andrew and the bands that you're playing there, musically, what was next after that? You're like, these guys aren't good enough for me.
They'll never make it.
They're failures.
I'm leaving.
Move on.
I can't take the two-tone.
Yeah. Two-tone. I'm a three-tone guy. Kind of guy.
Yeah. Well, that was actually quite funny how that all transpired as well, because I was playing with two or three different bands.
Right.
And then one became The Who.
No, The Who were already...
One was Eric Clapton.
Oh, he already mentioned it. He was with Dwight, wasn't he?
Who?
Dwight?
Dwight who?
Elton John.
Oh, yeah. It's Reggie Dwight.
Reggie.
It's funny because a whole bunch of people grew up within 3 to 4 miles of where I grew up.
Right.
Elton John lived 200 meters from my house.
Wow.
Wasn't Phil Collins?
I'm not sure exactly where Phil Collins was from. I don't know where he... But most of... all of...
You mentioned someone.
Duran were all from Pinner.
Oh, yeah.
Elton John was from Pinner.
Did you know these guys at all, or had you...
I ran into the Duran guys in the George pub in Pinner. They had already started to do some stuff around, I guess, about 80, or maybe it was when I came back from France that they were around. Anyway, they were a big name at one point, and I remember running into them at in the George pub in Pinner, where they used to drink quite regularly. Yeah. So, yeah.
Was there nuclear fallout in that area where you had all these people?
I don't know.
What happened?
That's amazing. Weird.
There was a lot of talent in that area.
There was something going on there. I know, something in the water. I don't know what it was, but a lot of people were from around there.
Right.
Very strange. Yeah.
So, George, you played with George and Andrew for a while? Or?
Not that long. When I was at school, and what happened was we made the first record.
Yeah.
And
now, you were telling me you were the lead singer, weren't you?
Well, He asked me to be.
Okay.
He asked me, well, what happened? It was kind of strange. We ended up making this record, and the way Andrew Ridgely tells it in one book, though I haven't read the other book, I'm not sure where you'd find it, but he said that I nearly got everybody killed in the van on the way to their first ever recording session. Because I wanted to come. The part of the reason
that Andy's a pilot.
And a race car driver. Oh my.
And a race car driver.
And a race car driver.
I might believe that version.
Yeah.
So what happened was, you see, what attracted them maybe to me, I mean, part of it was that Gav and I had a van.
Right.
Right. I mean, how many people have ended up in bands?
So
because
many.
They had a vehicle. Because
or a PA system.
Yeah, I had a PA system.
You're
in the band. Actually, it's very similar to how I actually ended up playing with the band in France that I eventually went to.
Well, the guy needed a ride, but that's another story.
The guy needed a ride to the south of France. So I got in that band without an audition. So, because I had the car.
I'm jumping ahead. Yeah, because
so,
it...
So we had this meeting.
You were killing Andrew, softly.
Yes. So what Music happened reference. Was we went to record the first record, and it was a thing called Rude Boys. And it was this awful ska thing, and I've not managed to find anywhere on the internet of a recording of it, but it went to rude boys. It's like, get on with it, like, this is crap. So George goes, well, how do you think we should do this? I said, well, it needs an intro, right? And there was Madness, and there was a band, I think, called Pig Bag or something in the UK. There was this sort of really raunchy, almost out of tune, almost amateur sort of style, which was sort of endearing,
right?
Style to the brass.
Yeah.
And I could do amateur on the saxophone. So I suggest, well, why don't you put a saxophone solo on it? You see all these things keep jumping into. So I wrote this saxophone solo. I says, the way you need to start this song is me, 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 me. It's not too different from a certain other saxophone intro. But that's how that intro went. You see, everything's derivative.
Right.
And
he stole it.
He's, oh, yeah, that'll work. I go, that's great. So I'd heard the tape, and I'd obviously listened to it at the wrong speed, the cassette he'd made of a demo. Because we got to the studio, and it's like, bruh, 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 I can't play that in that key. Like, that's like, I got to have four thumbs to get to. This is horrible. It's like the equivalent of C sharp.
On a sax.
On the sax. So I go, like, oh. So how are we going to do this? And then I used a trick. I says, well, can you slow the tape down a semitone? And now it'd be slower, so it'll be easier for me to play. It'll actually affect the tone of the saxophone, and I'll play the intro a semitone lower. And that's what I did on the original Rude Boys demo. And we'll come back to what you were asking me a second ago. Only 2 weeks ago, I was reading up, because we'd had a chat about all this stuff, and so start researching like weird stuff to do with Careless Whisper, and you've got all this story about Muscle Shoals or whatever it's called, the studio I went to in the States where he hated it,
right,
and brought it back and went through 12 saxophone players or whatever. The last saxophone player that actually did the recording of Careless Whisper, it turns out, pulled exactly the same trick.
Oh, they made him slow down half of it?
He had them slow down the tape a semitone so that he could play on a tenor saxophone, something where you needed actually to go into a different range, a different key, and it didn't phrase right. It was hard to play. So he had them slow the tape down, I think a semitone, so that he could play the intro for Careless Whisper on the tenor saxophone, but it's in a different key, and you could get the phrasing much easier because it flows better rather than cross-fingering all this. When you play a saxophone, you get into some keys where you can't make phrases flow because it's just too much clattering and clicking and cross-fingering going on to make it work. But if you can play in certain simple keys, it flows much better.
Sure.
So that's why this guy managed to make the intro a Careless Whisper in a way that then George Michael came back to the studio, because he wasn't actually in the studio when this guy recorded it. He just got called in on a session to do it. He comes in, he goes, that's what I've been looking for all along. But it turns out
that's funny.
That he pulled...
What comes around goes around.
He pulled exactly the same trick for that. Maybe he should have called me to do the intro. And maybe what was in his head to start with, that was the sort of phrasing that had come from that somewhere in his head. He wanted it to sound that way, and it did when you played in the keys that would flow and phrase that much better. So he probably didn't even remember that I had done that trick. I'd forgotten completely that I'd done that trick, but I was reading up on it and I was going, like, wow, that is really funny. The two songs that, one was his first ever demo, first time he'd set foot in a recording studio.
Yeah.
I did that. And his first huge hit, that also happened with the saxophone player. It's kind of weird how these things repeat. But so to come back to the, how did you end? The executive ended up folding. I think it was Andrew's brother was on the drums, and it was like it
just wasn't clicking.
It just wasn't working. Probably because most of the people weren't actually into the music they were playing, and you could tell.
Right.
But so they made this demo and it was going to get to all these guys that apparently they knew somebody who was going to make them all stars and blah, blah, blah. And big hopes. Right. And of course, dashed.
Everybody has the dreams.
Yeah, everybody has their dream. And it was like, meanwhile, I'm just playing pubs and stuff. And so Andrew and George called me into, it's actually a town a church hall in Bushy. I don't know why they had access to this place, but then we weren't meeting at their houses because I'd been to both their houses. They sat me down. They go, look, it's not working out, but we want to do all these new things and we want to go in a completely different direction, blah, blah, blah. And George was sort of like, well, you know, you sing really well and blah, blah, blah. And we think just the three of us would work to do the sort of things that we want to do. And then we'll maybe get other band members in once we've got a better idea of what we want to do. Are you in? And I'm like, I'm too busy. I mean, I don't know. Like, well, what do you want to do? Well, we're not really sure. And it was like, turns out George Michael was into all exactly the same music.
That you were into?
That I was into. But
you didn't talk about it.
Well, we talked about it a bit. And that was what was really funny because he's going, oh, yeah, I love that, and I love that, and I love that, and I feel like saying, well, why are you playing this crap? Right? If you love this stuff,
right?
You know, why all the Stevie Wonder stuff, and why this? Oh, it's what people want. It was what was hot in England
at the
time.
Yeah, right.
It's
right. So he was emulating somebody else's dream.
Yeah,
like
a certain style.
A style that wasn't even his, thinking it was popular and was going to be the moneymaker.
Yeah, because I think that he wanted to be a star.
Right.
They wanted to be stars, and they wanted to be the best pop band ever. Right?
Yeah.
It turned out being that.
Yeah.
One of them. But it didn't start from a place of, oh, we have this musical idea and a place we want to come from. We really hope everybody likes it because it's us. I hope people like it. It was never that. It was like, what should we play to get big?
The audience. The target
and then,
audience
and then,
at the time.
Because I think they realized that normally what happens is you have to do that stuff. You have to sell out a bit to get the success. And then hopefully one day, I mean, you hear it all the time with artists. And now I put the album together that I really want. Everybody goes, but it sucks.
Yeah, it sucks. You didn't do what you wanted to do at the beginning.
Exactly, right? So they got it,
right?
Whereas I was more sort of like, yeah, but I feel this. I'm not feeling it,
yeah.
Right? But not only was I not feeling it, but like, You told me that we were going to do all these things and it was going to be hugely successful and blah, blah, blah. And you knew all these people and told me the story. And I go, yeah, I want to be part of that. Well, we did it and it didn't work.
Right.
So now what, you know?
So that was the first business plan.
Yeah.
It's like a business. Like
yeah.
You have this vision for what you think is going to be successful based on all these inputs and what investors might want to hear and a whole bunch of other outside influences just so you can get going.
Mm.
If you don't have the people around you, you can't do these things alone. So part of it generally is you've got to figure out a way of bringing people together with a story that everybody can believe.
Mm.
Not necessarily with the heart that you want to emit, right?
Well, especially if you kind of oversell it.
Yeah.
You know, you've bought a lottery ticket at best.
Yeah.
Right?
It's all a lottery ticket. It's that 60% luck you were talking about.
Yeah, it's not a shoe-in.
Yes.
Right? It might be a shoe-in if your uncle is
Barry Gordy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know? Then, well, yeah. Then I can understand how that might work. But then he's just going to put some pretty boys together and some session musicians. And you got, like, in the UK at the time, you know, Rick Astley and all these stars. It was all very formulaic. It was all stock Aitken Waterman production. All their records sounded exactly the same, and people were buying them by the millions.
But that was the influence. That was the influence of the people that were there, that were driving it.
Yeah.
It was the producers, or it was the it wasn't the artists.
No,
they were driving it.
Yeah,
but if you have lots of money and you can generate a ton of awareness, that almost becomes fake popularity.
Yeah,
and
but
people will buy into the fake popularity.
It doesn't matter if it's fake. If it works, you've got to get over the. You've got to get in the room. And in the room in the UK back then meant you got to get on Top of the Pops.
Right.
There was one show. It was on every Thursday night in the UK. And if you were trying to break something, how could you be Top of the Pops in the top 40 if you've never sold a record to get into the top 40? That's such a catch 22. Mm-hmm. So how do people do it? And that's a whole different discussion about payola and music publishing and how the industry really works. Taylor Swift fills the stadium. Well, that's great. And she made $1 billion last year, or was it two? I don't remember. But that's great. But how do you get from here to there? Well, you got to play concerts. Yeah, but now people pay a fortune to go to the concerts because they're not subsidized. Who's going to subsidize that? And where are the small venues to play? Where is the Cavern in Liverpool? Mm-hmm. Where is, you know, Dingwalls in Camden? You know, where I saw the Tower of Power, they were awesome.
Oh, wow.
You know, in a club.
Yeah.
You know, where are these places? We're lucky in Waterloo because it seems suddenly it's like mushrooms. There are a lot of music people. There is a lot of talent, and there just seems to be something very weird
happening in this community,
bubbling under the surface, which is great. But I'm running into it daily, which is kind of fun.
Yeah.
But in most places in Nowheresville, USA, or particularly in the UK, I mean, there was an interview, Elton John was talking about this in an interview. He was saying, yeah, but where'd you play? How do you, you know, the clubs are closing weekly.
Yeah.
There are fewer clubs to go and play in. So, well, if you can't, Top of the Pops doesn't exist anymore. Where do you do it? So maybe the new, somewhere between a 200 to 400 person venue, which is a little club, and Wembley Stadium, maybe that gap is YouTube.
Yeah.
Maybe performing live music that you can actually see as live, which is, you know, I was thinking of, you know, I'd like to make a lot of recordings of people having fun and video that's time synced and everything so that it actually looks, hey, you see a Daryl's house awesome stuff, a tiny desk, that kind of thing. It's interesting and it's taken off because the video's there so you can prove to yourself that it's genuine. It's not faked. I'm sure they can fake. They were faking it in Korea. They got these bands that don't actually exist, and they made AI pop stars and AI videos and AI generated music, and they put all this rubbish together. And oh, look, and they're all stars, and the kids buying it because they don't know any better, I suppose. But generally speaking, it's that it's genuine, and you can prove it with your own eyes, and you can get a sense of the character of the people and see some outtakes and see how the sausage gets made.
You had mentioned this before to me that,
you know, that's
and then being able to set up your own party in your own house.
Yeah.
With that going, and you can pretend that you're sort of part of that whole.
Yeah,
whole
you can
feel.
Yeah, you can go every Saturday night to maybe if you have something you could do where you could, you could go every Saturday night and join me in my basement with another six of my best musician friends,
yeah,
and a couple of their friends, and we do something. Mm-hmm. And we might have a theme every week or what, but it's something that's going on. But then maybe because the money people, the people that organize the tours and the concerts, and maybe the big money guys, maybe they'll start watching, yeah, and they'll go, oh, this is interesting. Actually, these guys aren't half bad. Oh, you know, it's been mostly this music, but they've been doing some original music too. And oh, that's kind of interesting. That's cool. Hopefully something goes viral for somebody, and it's like, you know.
Well, that's the discovery process.
Yeah.
Well, this has been great. I mean, probably going to ask you to come back again in the future, because I know there's a lot more behind.
Yeah,
yeah, I think
your
we got
world.
About 10% there. I think that was about 10%.
Yeah, we could go on forever. Yeah. We got to chop it up a bit.
Yeah.
But no, so I'm just so happy that you joined us.
Yeah.
I appreciate the stories, and it's the connections, the authenticity, the realness. It's great to hear that. I hope that others will benefit from hearing these stories that Ed has and Steve has and yourself. And I think it's that exposure, because people don't necessarily get that every day. Ed's very good at making sure it happens, which makes him a very integral part of our team here. And Steve does it with music. And when we come up, meet people like you, it just makes our just keeps us going. It's just wonderful. So thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yeah, welcome. It's lots of fun.
Always, yeah, we'll do it again.
Always enjoy a coffee with Ed and you guys.
And a cold coffee at that.
Cold coffee. It's really, I make that noise again. That's,
yeah, it's good, isn't it? My ice
is
melted.
This is really good stuff. I didn't even need milk for sure.
Forget the tired old morning jolt. Why settle for a mere pick-me-up when you can have a taste of bliss that pulses through you like the opening chords of your favorite song? Eco Coffee's original blends don't just start your day right, they awaken it with an enchantment, a deep resonant pleasure. We're talking about that sexual healing kind of morning joy, a sensation that lingers long after the last drop. You can never go wrong with a little morning bliss that feels this good.